Lotus Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today we will continue listening to Tenjin's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davies. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello, and once more welcome to the program, where we've been talking about how to transform our self-cherishing attitude, the attitude that always places us and our desires before anything else, into an attitude that cherishes others more than anything else. This is the critical point in Shanti Deva's A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, which we've been following now for several months. The text is a manual on how to develop bodhicitta, the mind wishing to attain enlightenment to free all beings from suffering. And we're coming to the end of the 8th chapter on meditation. Specifically, this chapter instructs us on how to meditate on exchanging the self-cherishing attitude for an altruistic attitude. A goodly part of Shanti Deva's meditation is to reverse our mistaken grasping at our body as me and all mine, and realize how much it is in fact just a producer of unwanted substances and suffering. In our last program, we saw how Shanti Deva regarded the body without a mind or animating force as similar to a lump of wood or a clod of earth. Having accumulated suffering for no purpose because of my honoring and serving this body, what use is attachment and anger for this thing that is similar to a piece of wood? Whether I'm caring for my body in this way or whether it is being eaten by vultures, it has no attachment or hatred towards these things. Why then am I so attached to it? If my body knows no anger when derided and no pleasure when praised, for what reason am I wearing myself out like this? For all this, we are so attached to our body, we will spend millions of dollars and wear ourselves out caring for it and making it attractive both to ourselves and others. Listen as the American poet Yusuf Konum Moyaka extols his body in the poem Anodyne. I love how it swells into a temple where it is held prisoner, where the god of blame resides. I love slopes and peaks, the secret paths that make me selfish. I love my crooked feet shaped by vanity and work shoes made to outlast belief. The hardness coupling milk it can't fashion. I love the lips, salt and honeycomb on the tongue. The hair holding off rain and snow. The white moons on my fingernails. I love how everything begs blood into song and prayer inside an egg. A ghost hums through my bones like Pan's midnight flute, shaping internal laws beside a troubled river. I love this body made to weather the storm in the brain, raised out of the deep smell of fish and water hyacinth, out of rapture and the first regret. I love my big hands. I love it clear down to the soft, quick motor of each breath, the liver's 10 kinds of desire and the kidneys' lust for sugar. This skin, this sack of dung and joy, this spleen floating like a compass needle inside nighttime, always divining West Africa's dusty horizon. I love the birthmark posed like a fighting cock on my right shoulder blade. I love this body, this solo and ragtime jubilee behind the left nipple, because I know I was born to wear out at least 100 angels. And this is the poetic form of the love affair with the body that Shanti Deva prefigures in the first two lines of his next verse, lines that serve as an objection to the argument that the body is not worth our attachment to it. He writes, "But I want this body of mine, both it and I are friends. But since all beings want their bodies, Why do I not find joy in theirs? In this translation, in the first two lines, the objector stresses the intimacy between himself and his body and says that is reason enough to care so diligently for it. Shantideva replies that all beings are the same in appreciating their bodies, so why not give oneself over to making them happy and finding joy in their bodies? The Padmakara translation group translates this verse like this. Because of the appreciation, you will say, that others, or my friends, will have of it. They all appreciate the bodies that they have, so why do I not like them as my own? In his commentary, Kunzung Peldon and Pema Chodron in hers must be following this translation. For he comments, it might be argued that it's not because he's attached to his own body that he protects it. It's because other people, his friends, appreciate it. But, he reflects, if his mind protects his body because of their appreciation, since all beings, even worms, appreciate their bodies, why does he not like their bodies as much as his? He ought to do so, and to care for them as if they belong to him. The point here, as already explained in the section on equalizing of oneself and others, is that since there is no real difference between oneself and others, neither are there grounds for making a distinction between one's own body and the bodies of others. Shantideva decides then that he will use his body to do whatever he can to help other beings. Therefore, in order to benefit all beings, I shall give up this body without an attachment. But although it may have many faults, I should look after it while experiencing the results of my previous actions. He's not saying that he will completely disregard his body and not care for it at all. In fact, that will not do, for how will he be able to benefit others if his body is weak from hunger or overwork? This body is born and operates through karma and afflictive emotions, so it's not at all perfect. It has many faults. However, while it is the basis for the experience of results of previously created karma, such as sickness, loss, poverty, and so on, Shantideva says he must care for it is the basis of benefit to others. As Kunzun Belden writes, since Shantideva reflects it is inappropriate to cling to his body out of selfish concern, he will instead give it away without the slightest attachment for the great benefit of others, as their servant and utensil. And however many may be its blemishes, for it is filled with filth, and its maintenance is the occasion of much wrongdoing, nevertheless, he resolves he will use and protect it as a necessary implement, much as blacksmiths or carpenters might employ their tools. As it is said, misused, this body is a stone for sinking in samsara's depths. Well used, this body is a boat that sails to liberation. This body is the slave of evil or of good. Although this body is possessed of many defects, it is also the indispensable tool for virtue. Therefore, let us employ the body for its proper purpose. His Holiness the Dalai Lama also says, by emulating the examples of great personalities of the past, by pondering upon scriptural quotations and anecdotes taught by teachers, by employing all sorts of means, you should be able to develop a deep conviction that this present human body has great potential and that you shall never waste even a single moment of its use. On the other hand, not taking any essence of this precious human existence, but just wasting it, is almost like taking poison while being fully aware of the consequences of doing so. It's very wrong for people to feel deeply sad when they lose some money, while when they waste the precious moments of their lives, they do not have the slightest feeling of regret. Such an indifference comes as a result of not realizing the value and rarity of the precious human existence. Therefore, you should determine that on the basis of this precious human existence, you have the capability and capacity to undertake the practice of Dharma. And so Shantideva continues, so enough of this childish behavior. I shall follow in the footsteps of the wise, and having recalled the advice concerning conscientiousness, I shall turn away sleep and mental dullness. just like the compassionate sons of the conqueror, I shall patiently accept what I have to do. For if I do not make a constant effort day and night, when will my misery ever come to an end? Therefore, in order to dispel the obscurations, I shall withdraw my mind from mistaken ways and constantly place it in equipoise upon the perfect object. Here, Shantideva vows to take his body as his working basis, his necessary tool, writes Pema Chodron. When we do likewise, and enthusiastically follow in the footsteps of the wise, it will serve us well and carry us to unsurpassable enlightenment. In the Padmakara translation, the verse on patiently accepting what I have to do goes like this. Like the Buddha's heirs, in their compassion, I will take the burden, all that should be borne. For if I do not labor day and night, when will all my sorrows have an end? Now it all sounds a bit onerous with words like burden and labor. But Pema Chodron says that her teacher Trungpa Rinpoche used them in a positive sense. The great burden he felt to benefit sentient beings was one he carried joyfully, she writes. To labor night and day doesn't mean striving and struggling. It means persevering with the eagerness of an elephant diving into cool water, or with the delight of a swan descending on a lotus lake. Now I smile again at the odd image of an elephant diving into water. I wonder if she's ever seen how an elephant really enters water. However, the point of the verse is made, and perhaps the Stephen Batchelor translation, I shall patiently accept what I have to do, for if I do not make a constant effort day and night, when will my misery ever come to an end, better encourages us to take on the task. Kunsten Peldon glosses the last verse like this. The gaining of liberation is something for which we must strive. Therefore, Shantideva says that in order to remove the two obscuring veils, together with the habitual tendencies associated with them, he will turn himself from the mistaken path of holding apparent phenomena as truly real. He will continuously rest his mind in a state of meditative equipoise, in perfect concentration, the fusion of mental stillness and penetrative insight upon the Dharma Dhatu, the authentic and ultimate object of meditation. Pema Chodron writes that ultimately we need to get our priorities straight so that everything we do is motivated by the intention of awakening bodhicitta, the mind that wishes to gain enlightenment for the sake of benefiting all beings. Perhaps Thich Nhat Hanh, that Vietnamese master of mindfulness, describes best what it means to patiently accept what we have to do and make constant effort day and night. Here's an excerpt, quite long I must admit, from an enlightening interview he gave with Melvin McLeod of the Shambhala Sun. Thich Nhat Hanh started by explaining that meditation means coming home to oneself. Then you know how to take care of the things that are happening inside you, and you know how to take care of the things that happen around you, he said. All meditation exercises are aimed at bringing you back to your true home, to yourself. Without restoring your peace and calm and helping the world to restore peace and calm, you cannot go very far in the practice. What then, asked Melvin McLeod, is the difference between this true self, the self that you come home to, and how we normally think of ourselves? True self is non-self, the awareness that the self is made only of non-self elements, replied the master. There's no separation between self and other, and everything is interconnected. Once you are aware of that, you are no longer caught in the idea that you are a separate entity. And what happens to you when you realize that the true nature of the self is non-self, asked McLeod. It brings you insight. You know that your happiness and suffering depend on the happiness and suffering of others. That insight helps you not to do wrong things that will bring suffering to yourself and to other people. If you try to help your father to suffer less, you have a chance to suffer less. If you are able to help your son suffer less, then you, as a father, will suffer less. Thanks to the realization that there's no separate self, you realize that happiness and suffering are not individual matters. You see the nature of interconnectedness, and you know that to protect yourself, you have to protect the human beings around you. That is the goal of the practice, to realize non-self and interconnectedness. This is not just an idea or something you understand intellectually. You have to apply it to your daily life. Therefore, you need concentration to maintain this insight of non-self so that it can guide you in every moment. Nowadays, scientists are able to see the nature of non-self in the brain, in the body, in everything. But what they have found doesn't help them, because they cannot apply that insight to their daily lives. So they continue to suffer. That is why in Buddhism we speak of concentration. If you have the insight of non-self, if you have the insight of impermanence, you should make that insight into a concentration that you keep alive throughout the day. Then what you say, what you think, and what you do will then be in the light of that wisdom, and you will avoid making mistakes and creating suffering. Melvyn MacLeod then asked, "We human beings say that above all else we want love. We want to give love. We want to be loved. We know that love is the medicine that cures all ills. But how do we find love in our heart? Because often we can't. Love is the capacity to take care, to protect, to nourish," explained Thich Nhat Hanh. "If you're not capable of generating that kind of energy towards yourself, if you're not capable of taking care of yourself, of nourishing yourself, of protecting yourself, it is very difficult to take care of another person. In the Buddhist teaching, it's clear that to love oneself is the foundation of the love of other people. Love is a practice. Love is truly a practice." "Why don't we love ourselves?" MacLeod inquired, a question truly relevant to us self-disliking Westerners. "We may have a habit within ourselves of looking for happiness elsewhere than in the here and the now," replied the master. "We may lack the capacity to realize that happiness is possible in the here and now, that we already have enough conditions to be happy right now. The habit energy is to believe that happiness is not possible now, that we have to run to the future in order to get some more conditions for happiness. That prevents us from being established in the present moment, from getting in touch with the wonders of life that are available in the here and now. That is why happiness is not possible. To go home to the present moment, to take care of oneself, to get in touch with the wonders of life that are really available, that is already love. Love is to be kind to yourself, to be compassionate to yourself, to generate images of joy, and to look at everyone with eyes of equanimity and non-discrimination. That is something to be cultivated. Non-self can be achieved. It can be touched slowly. The truth can be cultivated. When you discover something, in the beginning you discover only part of it. If you continue, you have a chance to discover more. And finally, you discover the whole thing. When you love, if your love is true, you begin to see that the other person is a part of you, and you are a part of her or him. In that realization, there's already non-self. If you think that your happiness is different from their happiness, you've not seen anything of non-self, and happiness cannot be obtained. So, as you progress on the path of insight into non-self, the happiness brought to you by love will increase. When people love each other, the distinction, the limits, the frontier between them begins to dissolve, and they become one with the person they love. There's no longer any jealousy or anger, because if they're angry at the other person, they're angry at themselves. That is why non-self is not a theory, a doctrine, or an ideology, but a realization that can bring about a lot of happiness. "Peace," said Thich Nhat Hanh, "is the absence of separation, of discrimination." Melvyn MacLeod then asked about Thich Nhat Hanh's teaching on community or the Sangha. "Through practices such as the 14 mindfulness trainings of the Order of Interbeing, you define mindfulness in ways that are social, even political. You teach about communication techniques and the power of deep listening and loving speech. Why do you emphasize the community, interpersonal aspect?" he asked. Thich Nhat Hanh explained, You have experiences in the practice, peace, joy, transformation, and healing. And on that foundation, you help other people. You don't practice just as an individual, because you realize very soon on the path of practice that you should practice with a community if you want the transformation and healing to take place more quickly. That is taking refuge in the Sangha. In sharing the practice with others, the energy of mindfulness, concentration, and joy is much more powerful. That's what the Buddha liked to do. Everywhere he went, many monastics accompanied him, and that way the monastics could learn from his way of walking and sitting and interacting with people. Soon the community began to behave like an organism, with everyone engaged in the same energy of peace, joy, calm, and brotherhood. At the same time, everyone in the Sangha speaks for the Buddha, speaking for him not just by their words, but by the way they act and the way they treat people. That is why King Prasenjit told the Buddha, "Dear teacher, every time I see your community of monks and nuns, I have great faith in you." He meant that the Sangha is capable of representing the Buddha. The Buddha with the Sangha can achieve a lot of things. I don't think a teacher can do much without a community. It's like a musician who cannot perform without a musical instrument. The Sangha is very important. The insight and practice of the teacher can be seen in the Sangha. It has a much stronger effect when you share in the practice and the teaching as a Sangha. McLeod then concluded, "So, for the Dharma to be really powerful, we must transform not just ourselves, but in effect society." Thich Nhat Hanh agreed and said that Buddhism should always be engaged. It's not by cutting yourself off from society that you realize that. McLeod wondered if one reason the master emphasized community and society as a practice was the terrible conflict that he saw in his home country, Vietnam. He asked, "Did seeing a society destroyed by war, seeing the terrible stakes involved, heighten your concern for our community life?" "I think that's true," replied Thich Nhat Hanh. "It's the insight you get when you're in touch with the real situation. But it's also emphasized in the tradition. We say, I take refuge in Sangha, but Sangha is made up of individual practitioners. So you have to take care of yourself. Otherwise, you don't have much to contribute to the community because you do not have enough calm, peace, solidity, and freedom in your heart. That is why, in order to build a community, you have to build yourself at the same time. The community is in you, and you are in the community. You interpenetrate each other. That's why I emphasize Sangha building. That doesn't mean that you neglect your own practice. It is by taking good care of your breath, of your body, of your feelings, that you can build a good community, you see." Thich Nhat Hanh first came to the West in 1960, and by now has great familiarity with the Western mind. McLeod asked him what he thought were the best ways to present Buddhism to meet the needs of Western students. "I think Buddhism should open the door of psychology and healing to penetrate more easily into the Western world," was the reply. "As far as religion is concerned, the West already has plenty of belief in a supernatural being. It's not by the law of faith that you should enter the spiritual territory of the West, because the West has plenty of this. So the door of psychology is good. The Abhidharma literature of Buddhism represents a very rich understanding of the mind, which has been developed by many generations of Buddhists. If you approach the Western mind through the door of psychology, you may have better success helping people to understand their mind, helping people to practice in such a way that they can heal the mind and the body. The mind and body are very much linked to each other, and we can say that the practice of Buddhist meditation has the power to heal the body and the mind. You see this very clearly when you study the basic texts of Buddhist meditation, like the Anapanasati Sutra on the practice of mindful breathing and the Sutra of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. The practice of meditation helps us to release the tension within the body, within the mind, within the emotions, so that healing can take place. Even if you take a lot of medicine, it won't work very well if the tension is still strong in your body and your mind. So the Buddha offers very practical methods, such as breathing in, I'm aware of my body. Breathing out, I release the tension in my body. Breathing in, I'm aware of the emotion in me. Breathing out, I release the tension in the emotion. I embrace my body and my feelings with the energy of mindfulness. The practice of releasing tension in the body and mind is the foundation of healing. In the beginning, it helps to bring you relief. Then, with more mindfulness and concentration, you practice looking more deeply into the pain and the tension, and you find its roots, the cause of the ill-being. You discover the second noble truth. You can identify the source of that tension, that depression, that ill-being. And when you identify the roots of the suffering, namely the second noble truth, then you begin to see the fourth noble truth, the way that leads to the cessation of the ill-being, the tension and the pain. That is the most important thing to see, the path. If you follow the path, very soon ill-being will disappear and give way to well-being, which is the third noble truth. So the Buddhist principle is the principle of medicine. Another door that we should open is the door of ecology, because in Buddhism there's a deep respect towards animals, vegetables, and even minerals. In Mahayana Buddhism, we say that everyone has Buddha nature, not only humans, but animals, vegetables, and even minerals. When you study the Diamond Sutra, you can see that the Diamond Sutra is the oldest text on the protection of environment. The idea of self is removed, because self is made of non-self elements, and the idea of man is removed, because man is made of non-man elements, mainly animals, vegetables, minerals, and so on. That means that in order to protect man, you have to protect the non-man elements. It's very clear. So the door of ecology is a very wonderful door to open. And the door of peace, because Buddhism is about peace. The true Buddhist cannot refuse working for peace. And I think the door of feminism, the non-discrimination between genders. The Buddha opened the door for women to enter the holy order, and that was a very revolutionary act on his part. I think all these Dharma doors should be opened wide, so the West can receive the true teaching of the Buddha. These Dharma doors all exist within the roots of Buddhism, but many generations of Buddhists have lost these values. Buddhists should practice in such a way as to restore these values to the tradition, so they can offer them to other people. And that is where we will leave the interview. If you want to read the whole thing, you will find it on the Shambhala Sun website, www.shambhalasun.com. I hope you do not mind that I've spent some time with this interview, but because I think it's a wonderful explanation of how to practice with effort, but without strain, to develop the minds of genuine love, compassion, and insight. And now, we've come to the end of Shantideva's chapter on meditation, and the end of today's program. Thank you for being with us today, and I hope you'll join us again next week. Let's now just take a little time to dedicate all the benefit from the program to the enlightenment of all beings. And that, of course, includes yourself. Thank you. Have a wonderful week, and goodbye. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful, beneficial, empowering.